Hello and welcome to the Caring Instinct podcast. Our guest today is Dr. William Stixrud, a clinical neuropsychologist, the founder of the Stixrud Group, and the co-author of an absolutely unique book, The Self-Driven Child, known in the UK as The Thriving Child, as well as What Do You Say? Talking with Kids to Build Motivation, Stress Tolerance, and a Happy Home. As I'm going through this episode, I just want to turn every minute into a clip and just share and just let people hear it. I absolutely love this episode.
Yes. He's such a nice guy as well, isn't he?
Yes, he's such a lovely presence as well. The non-anxious presence.
Yeah. My favorite, I don't know if you've done this clip, but if I can request it, the homework one.
Do you remember? 100 years of research.
100 years of research on homework, and it either comes out as doesn't do anything or it makes things worse in terms of learning. 100 years.
This and many other discoveries await you in the podcast.
Enjoy.
Welcome, Dr. Stixrud. We're so excited to have you here. I heard you speak at this summit about helping children manage screen time, and I ordered The Self-Driven Child. And what happened in my house was my husband saw it and squirreled it away into his office. And for the first week, he was emerging from his office, reading me bits from the book out loud, wow, but not letting me read it by myself. He was just so blown away by this message. This was so important to him. And then he was sitting down, our eight-year-old, and asking him, so what would you say are the most stressful bits in your life? So thank you so much for this book. It's just such an important message.
You're welcome, and thank you.
And as we've just found out, it is better known in the UK as The Thriving Child. So if our UK listeners go searching for The Self-Driven Child, it's easier to find The Thriving Child, which is the name of the UK edition. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the same book, as far as I can tell. Yeah, the same book.
It's a book for parents of older children, teenagers. Is that fair to say?
No, I think that certainly a lot of it applies. Some of it, particularly at the end of the book, applies primarily to teenagers. But the idea that a sense of control is enormously important for mental health, for motivation, for well-being, and we can start to nurture it in little kids. In fact, I gave a lecture about the self-driven child a few years ago, and this guy came up to me and said, I just finished my doctoral dissertation on promoting autonomy in two-year-olds. So I think that we can start early to use some of these tools for building that internal sense of control in kids that it's so powerful for helping them go through life in a confident, not overly stressed, anxious way. That's my angle.
Yes. Yeah. I've got a two-year-old as well. And he will take control if you don't give it to him. So I love it.
I was going to say, I might think of my son as well, when he's four now, but when he was, you could see this, it really showed up for him. Just little, like trying to climb on the sofa. If I tried to get involved, I'd be growled at, you know, doing this.
And you think about, at least in the United States, you know, one of the first things that when the kids start to put more than one to two words together, they say, you aren't the boss of me.
Yeah.
and I think that very early on my parenting career, I had to make peace with the fact that you really can't make a kid do anything against their will. Mm. If they're little and they don't want to get in the car to go to grandma's, you can pick them up and put them in the car, but they aren't getting in the car. And just making peace with the fact that you can't make somebody do something, which means as parents, we are supposed to be able to make our kids turn out a certain way or do certain things. And so focusing on building in a responsible way, building a sense of control is really powerful.
That's a hard lesson to learn for parents, isn't it?
It is. In part, I will say that the Self-Driven Child has been out for 6 years now, and you know, we've lectured to thousands of people about it all over the world, really. And almost nobody questions the basic premise because the science is so strong supporting this idea. But it's hard, in part because if you're something you've been controlling, helicoptering parents, and you want to step back, you have less of a sense of control. And a low sense of control is the most stressful thing you can experience. So it's stressful. It can be frightening for parents to trust their kid that they can figure it out. The title of the second chapter of The Self-Driven Child is, I love you too much to fight with you about your schoolwork, or your homework. And so many parents find that they'll step away. Okay, you're on your own, or I'll help you, but I'm not going to fight with you about it. And after 2 days, the kid's not doing his homework. They say, well, this didn't work. And it does work, but you have to have the courage, and you have to be able to tolerate that stress of not knowing when it's going to happen.
The uncertainty. Yes, and I find there's an interesting combination in parenting today. We combine an often premature push for independence in things like sleep. We want our babies, yet alone toddlers, to sleep on their own. In things like manners, we want them to share, to say their pleases and thank yous, to be the sort of civilized members of society way before children are developmentally ready for it. And at the same time, we completely micromanage and helicopter parent all spheres that in our heads are connected to career, education. When stakes become too high, we think children just can't do it by themselves.
And, you know, it's a really interesting point. I think somebody told me this decades ago, but it said, don't do for a kid what the kid can do for himself. You know, and I think generally that, I mean, certainly a kid's sick or you just is tired, you do something for him that he could do for fine. But I think that on the whole, I think it's good for kids if they're capable of doing things for themselves that we encourage them to do it and don't do it for them. On the other hand, I think in America, this push to have kids grow up faster and faster is on steroids. Mm-hmm. There's a book written in 1981 in the United States called The Hurried Child. And somebody was observing that this American preoccupation with trying to make kids develop faster and faster and faster. Jean Piaget, the developmental psychologist?
Yeah.
He used to call it the American question, which is Piaget said, your children develop according to these natural sequences. And the American question was, how do we make them go faster? How do we speed it up?
Wow, that was so many years ago.
Yeah. So it's been like that for a long time. And I'd love to know in your country, but and one of the ways it manifests in this country is trying to teach kids who are five what we used to teach seven-year-olds. That kind of thing. Yeah, with a mistaken idea that if they learn it early, they'll be better at it when they're older, and they just aren't. And most of what we see in education is not at all informed by an understanding of the brain and brain development. It's hard for parents because schools basically have the schools in the United States, I can't think of a school that really places healthy brain development as the highest goal. And so parents have to adapt to it with the fear and competition and the pressure and the pushing. And when we don't know their ways, we try to maintain our own sense of control by micromanaging. So I think you're exactly right. Certainly one of the things that Ned and I focus on, my co-author and I focus on, is the idea that this is based on some research on a sense of control, where Steve Mayer at the University of Colorado for years studied rats. And he had two rats in a plexiglass cage, rat A and rat B, and there's tails outside the cage with an electrode in the tail. And rat A would get, the tail would get a little shock, and there's a wheel inside the cage, and he discovered if he turns the wheel, the shock stops. Rat B turns the wheel and nothing happens. Rat A has that experience a few times of turning the wheel and being able to control a stressful situation. And when he's turning the wheel, his prefrontal cortex activates to go into coping mode and dampens down the stress response. So he's turning the wheel, and even when you disconnect the wheel, he's still getting shocked. He's just turning that wheel. He's not very stressed because he's coping. We want kids to be able, as much as possible, solve their own problems when they can, because that conditions the brain when something stressful happens to activate the prefrontal cortex and go into coping mode, as opposed to trying to avoid or panicking or freaking out. So on the one hand, you know, I want kids to be as independent as they can. I mean, that's they love that too. On the other hand, I think that solving their own problems, making their own decisions, is an important part of developing that self-driven child. On the other hand, kids need structure. They need limits. If you try to make them be more independent than they are, it just makes them more anxious. They need adult-provided structure and direction to feel safe.
Exactly. And we just forget the caring that we sometimes offer to each other, the grown-ups, the spouses, the partners. I can perfectly make my own cup of tea, but sometimes I just want my husband to make a cup of tea for me, you know? Yeah.
Right.
And I really hope he won't be thinking, I won't do anything for you that you can do by yourself. But we sometimes forget to extend the same grace to our kids.
Right. And that's why I think that as a general principle, I think that it works, but God, you know, kids tired, kids sick, just once in a while, it's his birthday, just once in a while, do something nice for him. You got the day off, buddy. I mean,
it's a very intuitive process to do that dance, isn't it? Of going through the day and this is the time, this is not the time.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that the closer relationship we have with the kid, the easier it is to kind of figure out what does the kid need right now? What do I need right now?
Yeah.
What's best way to balance things out.
One of my concerns about finding this time for this self-directedness to come about is, it's like you mentioned in school, the same thing happens here. The idea is we'll get them to do it a few years earlier, and then if they can do it then that means things are going well. So, and obviously that takes more time, takes up more space. It's much harder to find the self-directedness. For instance, I think about the classic, like the academic stuff, like maybe reading. A child starts school at reading, you know, they're told to read all the time. We get told, okay, they go home, it's homework to read. It's much harder to find that time to find your own space for reading, if you see what I mean.
I do. the National Public Radio in America interviewed me and my daughter after self-driven child came out, because it says in the self-driven child that when my daughter was in high school, she came to one of my lectures on the adolescent brain, and I'd said that great grades, you can flunk all your high school classes, and then you can go to a community college class, at least in the United States, and then you go to most of the universities in the country, and they don't want to see your high school transcript. So I told her, because I don't really care about your grades. And my daughter, on the way home from the lecture, said, I bet you don't really believe that. I offered her $100 for a C.
Yeah,
just to prove this, it's not that big a deal, you know. And she never took me up on it. But the guy from National Public Radio kind of liked that idea, so he interviewed her, and she said one of the things she remembered was that when she was like in second grade, the teacher said the assignment was to read for 20 minutes at home. And next morning, I said, you know, respectfully, I'm not going to ruin reading for her by making an assignment, and so she's not going to do it. And she got a PhD in economics and learned reasonably well, you know. And especially when you think that there's no evidence that homework contributes to learning in elementary school after 100 years of research.
100 years.
Yeah. I did a literature review of the relationship between homework and learning in 1986. Really? And I was stunned to learn what I just said, that nobody had shown that homework contributes to learning in elementary school. And some studies actually found that the more homework kids had, the less they learned, because kind of they got turned them off to school. 40 years later, the most recent research I've seen is about 2010. Still the same thing.
Yeah.
And do you know the name Peter Gray?
Yeah.
Yes.
I love the work of Peter Gray, who's at Boston University. He studies play from an evolutionary point of view. And his motto is kids need less school, more play. Mm-hmm. And I think he's exactly right. You think about all the hours kids spend in school, bored, learning not very much. There's so much wasted time. And especially if we try to teach them at younger and younger ages, because if you wait till a kid's 7, they'll learn to read in a couple months. If you start at 5, you know, it'll take 2 years.
And that's time wasted from the other angle, wasted in play.
Completely.
And one of the things I was going to ask about play is, because play is where the self-drivenness is just, it's just there. If you're playing, it's there, isn't it? Is that right?
That's the thing that this Peter Gray, I saw a really interesting paper while we were working on the self-driven child. He pointed out there's a researcher in California who studies generational differences. And she's been pointing out for decades that kids are getting more and more anxious, more and more depressed, and also having an increasingly low sense of control over their own lives. And he said the thing that links these two is play. Because as you're saying, Joe, when kids go off and play on their own, decades ago, kids just go off and play in the neighborhood on their own. And on the weekends, they come back at dinner time. Parents had no idea what they were doing. They were creating their own worlds, their own games. It was completely self-directed. And he said that kind of self-directed play that contributes to that healthy sense of control that makes you almost invulnerable to anxiety and depression.
Invulnerable, wow.
This guy who studies this, the rat A and rat B, he says that a sense of control inoculates you from the harmful effects of stress.
Really?
I can talk about that more, but that it really does seem to be true, and play seems to be a huge part of that.
Wow. Oh, we just need a ministry for education to finally read The Self-Driven Child, your work, the works of Peter Gray, to finally see these solid research, as you've said, hundred years of research and homework. Because I believe teachers, experienced teachers, understand it. I used to be a teacher, and we all knew that what would take a 5-year-old 3 months to learn, a 7-year-old will learn in 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's research in multiple languages. At age 7 is the best time to teach kids to read, because they learn so efficiently. And when I was in graduate school, you can tell a long time ago, when I was in graduate school, people studied readiness. People in child development studied readiness, meaning when's the best time to teach kids something? And if you're going to teach a kid to ride a bike, I mean, you could start in when they're 4 in preschool and teach them, here's the wheels, here's the handlebars. And by the time they're 6, they'll be riding a bike. Or you could wait till they're 6, 2 weeks, they'd be riding a bike. People in education now either don't know about or don't care about readiness. If you looked at most schools, at least in the United States, you never have any idea that there's been 40 years of neuroscience and 40 years of attempting to apply neuroscience to education. Schools have so much power, and families have so much power to turn this around if we start to recognize the importance of a sense of control, what contributes to healthy brain development, and making that healthy brain development our highest priority. Most of the kids that I work with here have the idea that the highest priority, their whole childhood and adolescence, is where they go to college. It's the most important thing. And from my point of view, the most important thing is sculpting a brain that's healthy, that is goal-directed, that can enjoy its own success. And I see so many kids who are very successful, but they're completely miserable. And so many of their parents are highly successful, very wealthy, and very miserable. That's what I focus on, is that sculpting that healthy brain, and sense of control is really a powerful part of that.
And in terms of that, probably my favorite bit in the book is where you talk about how our brains get sculpted in play, in what parents might see as a completely useless hobby. But this is when that brain is getting built. And your example was of playing the guitar in your band.
Yeah, I read some years ago that there's a guy by the name of Reed Larson, who is a social scientist in the United States, who studies adolescents. And for a while, he was studying how do children turn into self-motivated adolescents and adults. What he concluded, it wasn't dutifully doing their homework every night. It was what he called the passionate pursuit of pastimes. And the point he made is if a three-year-old is building something with Legos, and do you have Legos? With Legos, and he's really focused on it, and he's really trying to build a high tower, that what's happening to the brain is a combination of high focus, high determination, high effort, and low stress. And he said that that's the kind of brain state that we live most of our life in, a state of full attention, full engagement, low stress. When I read that, what I thought about was that when I was a teenager, I was in high school, I was an average student, and I never turned anything on in time. I just cut corners constantly. I never got past page 25 in a book, but I was passionate about rock and roll. And at that time, I played organ in a band, and I'd come home from high school, and I'd tell myself, okay, I'll work on music for an hour, and then I'll do homework. And I'd come out of this room where I had an organ and a record player. 3 hours later, I have no idea what time it was, having been so absorbed in the music, trying to learn new songs or teach myself chord structure or something. My father was diagnosed with cancer my senior year in high school and died at the end of the year. And it kind of woke me up. I think it matured me to realize I better take this more seriously. I started college as a straight A student. It wasn't that I got smarter over the summer. I really think I sculpted a brain that initially through sports and particularly through rock and roll, that when school became important to me, I could go pedal to the metal. I could go into that brain state of high focus, high determination, high energy, low stress. And so I think it makes complete sense to me.
Yes. I think Gordon Newfold says, we used to think school built brains. We now realize play builds the brain that school later on uses.
Oh, that's really well put. I mean, just the crazy thing is, all the young mammals, all mammals, they play. That's how they learn to be an adult. I have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old granddaughter who really have had very little exposure to screens. They've watched some movies, but they don't have an iPad. They don't have games, electronic games. And all they do is play. All they do is make up their own games. They're buying dolls and creating, and making this story. And it's so beautiful to watch. And I think that we're depriving kids of something so important from an evolutionary point of view. The human mammals the young have always played. They make up games. They play adult roles. They work out their own problems. They engage in rough and tumble to kind of test limits, these boys do. And this is how they learn kind of to be an adult. Yeah, I think that if we do two things to help kids, we allow them to sleep more and play more, in my opinion.
It's just so, the frustrating thing for me is trying to sell that to a school or an organ, you know, why doesn't it sink in to a lot of people? Do you have a sense?
Well, I think we're going to see it turn around. I really do think it turn around. There's a big movement in the United States towards self-directed learning and school programs that really focus on student autonomy. And they're really starting to focus on the brain. There's not a lot. In most of the school programs, as I said, you never have any idea that people know about or care about the brain. But I think things are such, at least in the United States, the state of mental, the Surgeon General of the United States last year called the mental health status of adolescents the defining public health crisis of our lifetime.
Okay.
And it turns out that young adults in the United States are even more unhappy, even more anxious than adolescents are. And so I think that we're seeing what we're doing now is not working. And I think we have a lot of good alternatives. I've seen schools where I've done studies in schools where kids practice transcendental meditation, and it's life-changing for the teachers and for the kids in the school. I think there's many good things. There's schools where they implement a lot of physical exercise as opposed to just general PE, where it's aerobic kind of exercise, and things get so much better. We have so many tools to do this. And I think we're going to hit a tipping point here before too long, where we realize what we're doing is not working. And the problem for the United States is that much of the educational policy is made by educators, is made by legislators who don't have any knowledge of education and certainly have none about the brain. People are going to realize that we don't want a population where more than half the kids are anxious and depressed. More than half the adults are anxious and depressed. It's not going to work out very well. We're going to have to focus on doing things differently when they're young so they're sculpting healthy brains. I think, you know, that I'm pretty optimistic about turning the ship around because people see their own kids suffering so much.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Sudbury schools?
I am. Yeah.
I worked for a Sudbury home education school here in the first one here, but we have some alternative education practices starting to sprout more and more, but they're really hard to get off the ground and stay alive.
No, it's completely true. And I consulted with somebody earlier this week who has a school that was based on Neil Summerhill.
Yeah.
The same kind of thing. And where kids have so much independence, and he's got 50 kids in his school. And what I was telling him is that I've been involved with a group of educators in the United States who are really focused on student autonomy, student well-being, self-directed learning. And I've seen teachers in traditional classrooms who just start to say things like, here's what I'd like you to do tonight. Here's an assignment. I think it'll help you. Here's why I want you to do it. And I want you to know if it helped, let me know if it helps you. And let me know how long it takes you. If it doesn't help you, I don't want to be assigning stuff that's not helpful to you. So yeah. You start treating respectfully and it's not, I'm not going to grade it, but let me know if this is helpful. I've seen schools where teachers are starting to do that. I've seen schools where kids have their major academics in the morning and afternoon, they're working on their own projects. And I went to a rural part of Virginia and some kids were working on kind of computer modeling and some kids were trying to build a state-of-the-art chicken coop. You know, very different things, but these kids were so absorbed in their own projects and researching everything they needed to learn to do them. And I've seen schools where, I saw a high school where it's all student, but adults are consultants and guides to the kids. And I interviewed the kids and they're much less stressed. They get to sleep more, that they're learning more. And the teachers love it because they get to be kind of guides or mentors to the kids. And they really feel I'm really influencing these kids' life, which is why I became a teacher anyway, in the first place. So
yeah.
I think there's models developing. And I think Sudbury maybe a little told this guy that Sudbury idea. I think it's not this idea of kids decide. Kids don't need to decide everything. They just have a sense of control. Yeah. It doesn't mean that we can't say, here's some structure. Here's what I want you to do. Here's the requirement here. It doesn't mean we can't do that. It doesn't mean we say, I want you to work on this for a while, but it just means that we as much as we can, they have some choice, they're treated respectfully. I said, if you want to build a school, keep that love for independence and autonomy and respect for the kid, but also trying to make it more appealing to more people by showing how this can affect achievement and their development over time.
And this can be such minimal effort. As a teacher, I used to work at a Montessori school, and then I went to a very sort of traditional classroom, and I taught English as a foreign language. So I had this class of 7-year-olds, but with my Montessori background, all I did was I took a module from the English textbook. And the module is, it's very simply a grammar point, some new vocabulary, and then exercises, various exercises. And I copied the pages and I cut it up and I created stations and children could go and they could come and learn a grammar point with me. And then they could find the exercise and they could do exercises in different orders and they could choose who they would like to work with. This was exactly the same hour and a half of a lesson. This was exactly the same textbook. But the engagement, the empowerment in these kids, it was a miracle, honestly. So they went from being told, okay, open to page 72, exercise 1, to being able to choose. They did the same work, but much faster and much happier. Because they could start with exercise 5 and then go to exercise 2. And they could come to me and ask questions at any point. And it's just this control. and freedom and choice.
It's so beautiful, Olga. And it just, I mean, for me, it just hearing that story, it just strengthens my optimism that we can turn this around, that there's models that work. There's hundreds of studies on promoting autonomy in kids and the benefit that they get educationally, and promoting autonomy in teachers as well. We know all kinds of things that can help kids, and just a matter of having the will to do it.
Exactly.
Something that comes up for me, going back a bit to learning, trying to get everything learned earlier, and when you talked about the bike, so I noticed that there's an anxiety for me there with the bike for some reason. I want her to learn early so she can, but it comes from a place of anxiety. And I'm curious about that generally, you know, with education everywhere. How do we shine a light on that?
Where
do we go with that?
Yeah. And certainly some kids are ready to ride a bike by four, just the most aren't, you know, and all this pressure to get kids to do things at younger and younger ages, just based on fear that other kids are going to get ahead of my kid. Mm-hmm. I know what you're talking about, Joe. I mean, when my daughter was in kindergarten, she's really young for grade, and they taught the alphabet. They didn't really teach reading in kindergarten. It's a pretty progressive school. But some kids were reading in kindergarten, and it made me a little anxious. You know, I don't want my kid to fall behind and this and that. But I just said, okay, I know that the best time to teach a kid to read is age 7. So I'm going to wait and to kind of see. And by the time she was in first grade, she was an excellent reader. But I know that we all have that fear that other kids are going to get ahead of us if we don't push them. My neighbor's kid has 2 hours of homework, and my kid only has a half hour. That kid's going to get ahead of mine. Mm-hmm. And then we remind, you don't need to do 2 hours of homework to learn. In fact, if you do hours of homework, you might learn less. And I just think we need to support each other in remembering what's true, what we know about what kids need, and just kind of going against these fearful, delusional ideas that somehow if we just get them doing, they're better at it earlier, they'll be better at it later, or the way they develop their potential is by being pushed all the time. That's how you maximize. Well, the way you maximize potential is by creating a life that you're happy with, in my opinion. And because I see so many people I see a lot of bright kids who feel, I know I'm bright, I'm expected to achieve an extremely high level, and they're just miserable. Mm-hmm. And I just tell them that you maximize your potential by creating a life that you're happy with.
And of course, this incredible message in your book that invites parents to separate our anxiety about our children's future from our actual children. Our anxiety belongs to us, and it's not our child's job to resolve it for us.
That's true. Yeah, we have a chapter in the book called A Non-Anxious Presence. And I didn't make that term. I wish I did, but I didn't make that term up. I got it from someone named Edwin Friedman, who studied systems, including family systems, organization, churches, synagogues, schools, corporations. And he concluded that organizations work best if the people in charge are not highly anxious and emotionally reactive. And you think about it as a parent, if you got an infant who's crying, it's much easier to help them and soothe them if you stay calm. If you've got a 3-year-old in the store who's having a tantrum, it's much easier to deal with it if you stay calm. You got a 15-year-old who just got suspended today for a day from school. It's much easier to help, to really be helpful, if you can stay calm and not overreact. And we know, in our second book particularly, we talk about this idea that there's something called emotional contagion, where virtually all emotions are contagious. We know, for example, if a kid is sitting in a fifth grade kid is sitting in class with a teacher who's really burned out, that the kid's stress levels are much higher, that stress hormone levels are much higher than kids who have an engaged teacher. And also the same is true for calm is contagious. And the United States Navy SEALs, this elite group of people in the Navy, that their motto is, calm is contagious, because they're sent into these high conflict places to try to bring order and peace. And remember, the calm is contagious. We ask parents to think about moving in this direction of being a non-anxious presence in your family, making home feel like a safe base. It's not, the world is stressful enough. Ideally, when we come home, it's a really safe base where you can recover from stress. And one of the things that we recommend in terms of moving that direction of non-anxious presence is really realizing that all our fear, all our anxiety about our kids is about the future. Because you know, if your kid is struggling in some way now, and I said to you, I have a crystal ball, and I've seen your kid is going to turn out great. You wouldn't worry about what's happening right now because you know it's just part of their path. It's kind of a rough patch; they'll get through it. I've been saying when in my last couple of lectures that because I've been a neuropsychologist for 40 years, I've tested thousands of kids, and I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of kids who were really miserable, really hot mess, really struggling at various points of the development, who've turned out great. And I wish I could implant in everybody's brain the circuits of my brain that just know that have all that experience and see that know all those kids, and just where a kid's going a hard time. I don't go to, oh my God, they'll end up living in the basement or they'll end up in jail. I don't go there because I've just seen some. I just talked to the kid recently. For all 4 years of high school, he was in a therapeutic boarding program. He had serious emotional problems. He just started his own practice as a neuropsychologist, and he's incredible. You know, and anybody who knew him, even in high school, would say, that's no way. But I've seen that so much. But I think just taking this long view, and if kids are struggling, resisting the temptation to think, oh my God, this will screw up their whole life, to think, okay, this is part of their path. And making peace with it, okay, and then supporting them, helping them, but making peace with the fact that, okay, this is where they are now. This must be part of their path.
Oh, this is so good. Be the non-anxious presence.
I'm thinking of autobiographies or podcasts. You hear people's like, how many times do you hear the troubles and strife younger? And when you see where they are, it's so hard to keep that in mind.
I know, but so many of us had the experience. The first time I went to graduate school, I flunked out. I was so anxious and insecure. I went for 20 weeks without turning in a single assignment, and so I flunked out. And for a while, I felt like my whole life gone up in smoke. I had no idea what I was going to do. I was very discouraged, and it took me probably 6 weeks to realize it was the best possible thing that could have happened to me, because I always felt like an imposter as in English literature. I was an imposter. I wasn't really a literary type. And honest to God, this one professor gave me an F. Everybody else said, oh, just I'll give you an incomplete, you make up the work. This one guy flunked me, so I couldn't continue. And I was really mad at him. 6 weeks later, I started to say, I hope at some point I run into this guy and I can thank him for flunking me. And in fact, about a year and a half later, I went back to graduate school in education and then eventually psychology. And I saw him on the campus of a different university. He's at the university I was going to. And he'd come up from his university for a conference. And I was able to go up and thank him for flunking. But it didn't feel like that. I'm sure my parents were concerned about what was going to happen here. Almost all of us have experiences where something hard happened and it turned out to be fine. My co-author, Ned Johnson, who's one of the most inspiring people to be around, I mean, he was in a psychiatric hospital for 3 months of seventh grade. And I just know hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories like that. So, and we know the most useful thing that I've ever learned about brain development is how slow the prefrontal cortex develops. And we know that the cognitive functions aren't mature till 25, plus minus 3. The emotional regulation functions aren't mature till 32, plus minus 3. So we never give up on a kid. I've seen kids who are really struggling at 18 or 19 who are very together by the time they're 25.
We just see them as young adults rather than someone who's still very mature.
Right.
Which does not mean they can't make decisions, quite the opposite.
Well, you know, I think that there's a chapter in Self-Driven Child it's called It's Your Call. Mm-hmm. And it's about the wisdom of encouraging kids to make their own decisions. It doesn't mean that a five-year-old gets to decide everything for the family. But the idea is that I think the best message you can give, particularly a teenager, is I have confidence in your ability to make decisions about your own life and to learn from your mistakes. And I want you to have a ton of experience doing that. And we know that kids are really fully capable, if we help them understand a situation, of making good decisions for themselves. And we also know that there's a neurologist by the name of Antonio Damasio, who studied decision making. And we used to think that we make our best decisions purely rationally, you know, putting our feelings aside. And Damasio showed if you lesion the circuits, emotional circuits, and people who really were the emotional circuits in the brain are not working, they can't decide what to have for breakfast because decisions are rooted in emotion. And we want kids turning into children and teenagers. What's important to me? What do I want? If I make this decision, how it'll affect my family? How it'll affect my friends? Like, we want them tuning into their own emotions and ultimately trusting themselves. And I just talked to a mom who I've known for a long time. I never tested her kids, but I've known this mother for a long time. I met her kids, and she was telling me she's saying, I've been preaching this gospel for a long time, this sense of control and respect for kids and decision making. And she said, I'm so grateful to you for teaching me about this, because my kid, he's 35 years old. He's the happiest person I know. And he didn't pursue a path that I thought he's a rock and roll musician. And he does these service jobs part time to make enough money. He's engaged to be married. And he's the happiest person I know. And his wife said, his fiance says, he's the most confident person I've ever known because he trusts his own decisions. So I think we can start from early on. Do you want to do it this way or that way? Little kids, do you want to wear this outfit or that way? We're encouraging to make decisions. And ultimately, by the time they're teenagers, by saying, I want you to make the important decisions in your own life. I'm going to help you. I'll tell you what my opinion, you can decide. But I want you to practice making these kinds of decisions, because that's how you become a good decision maker, is by trying something out, seeing how it goes, and learning from it.
And this is, again, a beautiful invitation. We're creatures of attachment, and a lot of the time, especially when we're immature, we will make the decision that we feel our parents are looking for. And this is a beautiful invitation. I love you whatever you decide. So you try. You go for it.
It is. It is. And the older I get, the more humble I get about knowing what's best for a kid. Mm-hmm. In part because when do you decide whether something was a good decision or bad decision? Is the next day? Is it 2 years later? Is it 5 years later? Because so many times that what looks like a good decision doesn't seem to go well, and vice versa. That's why none of us always make good decisions. But I want kids to be able to trust their own gut, to seek out help when they need it to make a decision. I want them to know how to think rationally as well as trusting their own gut. And I think that they need practice doing it. And just expressing, when you say to a kid, I have confidence in your ability to make this decision for yourself, it just grows them up in such a beautiful way. It's a really wonderful expression of confidence in them as people who can make their own way in this world.
Indeed. Oh, I just love it so much. There's another one that the UK government has thought of in their eternal wisdom, or at least while they are consulting, and they might go ahead with the vote on this. They've been advised to shorten summer holidays to 4 weeks. At the moment it's 6 weeks, and they'd like to shorten it to 4 weeks. Well, I think the main motivation is they're trying to improve the attendance by not spending any money, because they are adding extra holiday time to February and November, the sort of darkest, coldest months in the UK. But the main argument that they are presenting is, of course, the dreaded loss of learning over the summer. How can we? Yes, you're laughing. I mean, there are countries where children have 3 months of holidays. The whole summer was of holidays. But this, oh my God, these 6 weeks holiday, all the things that they forget. And then we have to spend time reteaching them in the autumn. That's right. The main argument.
Right. So So they're talking about shortening by 2 weeks. What? How much really could you forget in those 2 weeks? You know, it seems to me that I really do feel that it's because the reason the kids forget so much is that they're so tired and they're so stressed, their brains don't work. And we try to cram so much more stuff in their heads that they can actually learn. When I was in high school in the 1960s, biology textbook was 350 pages. And now, I mean, the online book, they're 1,200 pages, and it's the same semester, the same 2 semesters. And we expect that the average high school kid now, at least in the United States, and certainly many, many countries around the world, sleeps about 6 hours a night, where they need 9 to 10, not to feel tired. That's the main reason why kids lose learning, is that they don't learn it very well. It doesn't stick in their memory very well because they don't sleep enough. And so I just think that the idea of getting even more control, cramming more and more stuff into you, taking 2 weeks, it's just so counterproductive. It's absurd. And the idea that kids can't benefit from 6 weeks of play or being with their family or working on the projects they're interested in or hanging out with their friends is beyond absurd.
It is. And it's, again, this linear thinking. The more, the better. The earlier, the better. Well,
that's such a good point. And you know, we know from research on homework in high school that after an hour and a half or 2 hours, it's counterproductive. And yet some of the kids in the high-achieving schools are spending 3 or 4 hours in homework a night. And all it does, it increases the rate of forgetting. They don't really learn more because you can't cram. There's a limit to how much you can cram in your brain and remember. It just increases the rate of forgetting.
And the frustrating thing, very common here as well, I'm sure over there, is when it doesn't work, then we say, oh, there must be a problem with the child.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm somebody who tests kids, and there are kids who have trouble. Some things are really hard for them, but I think that we make things even so much harder by not paying attention to really how their brains work, what's really good for them. There's a new article that just came out at The Atlantic about the idea that trying to turn around this phone-based childhood. And saying that, you know, the environment that kids are growing up in is simply toxic to their development, the more exposure they have to phones and electronics. And so I think that if we really focus on what's good for the brain, what's good for development, and prioritize that, we'll do a lot better. I mean, and as Ned and I say, if we are teachers, we'd much rather teach a kid for 4 hours who slept for 8 than teach them for 8 hours if they slept for 4.
Yeah.
Right? So it's so much more efficient.
You're hopeful about the future of education. And I wonder how much the rise of AI might change things. Suddenly, the value of sitting there and writing a long essay has gone out of the window because ChatGPT can do it within seconds. What AI is not doing is the physical work, is caring after people and animals and the planet. What do you think the implications might be? First of all, well, obviously the obvious one, even more uncertainty, even more parental anxiety.
Yeah. I just think it's changing so fast. It's changing so fast that I don't know. I mean, it's kind of beyond my pay grade. I haven't really studied the possible implications. I haven't read the futurists' kind of speculation about this. And what I focus on, because I'm a neuropsychologist, I've been asked probably 20 years ago to start the first time to lecture about how technology affects kids' brains. And what I said is that there's things that we know about human development, they haven't changed in the last 200,000 years. You know? Mm-hmm. And one is that you folks both are very knowledgeable about attachment. And this really interesting study in California where years ago, where they measured the security of attachment, toddlers' security of attachment to their parents at 18 months. and it's a better predictor of whether they finish college than their SAT scores or their high school grades. So feeling safe in your own skin, feeling safe in the world is hugely important. And you see the level of anxiety now that in this completely tech-driven culture that it's not making people feel safe. So when I think about the idea just that since the advent of electric light, we adults sleep a couple hours less than we did 100 years ago, and kids sleep even less than they did 30 years ago. And so I kind of take a focus on what we all have human organisms. You know, we're all human organisms. We're all mammals. What do we need? And so in terms of if AI, certainly there's AI programs working on doing neuropsychological evaluations. And I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen if AI is able to take over most of the white collar jobs. Your point, it's not going to go and fix the toilet. You know, so it may be that this preoccupation with everybody going to college now, maybe that's going to change. Where being a plumber, being an electrician, where AI is not going to do that, maybe a better thing. So I don't know, but I do think that whatever we want to keep a focus on the health of kids' brains, and I think about these four goals of emotional development related to the brain. And one is we want kids to have a healthy stress response, meaning when something really stressful happens, your stress hormones jack up quickly so you can deal with it instinctively. And as soon as it's over, the stress hormones go down quickly. What we see a lot in anxious kids is that they have chronically high stress hormones. Something really stressful happens, they jack up a bit, takes forever to go back down. So a healthy stress response, we want them to have what I call high stress tolerance, or being able to function well in stressful situations. We want them to be resilient. And we want them to be increasingly have a sense of peace and connectedness in this world. And that's what I focus. How do we promote that? Because that's going to make kids more adaptive. It's going to make them more able to adjust to change or figure things out, to roll with the punches. So I don't know. It's people who thought about this a lot more than I have. It's a wonderful question. I just don't know. But I do know that the people who are going to do best are the people who are the most flexible and the most adaptable.
I think that even the people who have thought about it a lot don't know at the moment.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. It's so unpredictable. And I think like all technology, when Facebook started out as something to connect people, and we have unprecedented levels of loneliness now in people who are connected all the time electronically, and that it didn't quite turn out that way. There's so many unintended consequences. Who knows? So I just keep focusing on wanting healthy development for kids, so they'll be able to handle whatever happened.
Just something you notice as well, generally with self-drivenness, when it's not there, it's almost become a thing that we try and teach children. You should be like this, and it's like, oh, now I've told you, that should be enough for it to start happening.
I see
that happen all the time in schools.
Give me an example, Joe.
You might see that this self-drivenness is not in a child. They're forgetting things. They're not engaged. And so a teacher shows up, or someone came from and says, I just need to tell them that it's about being self-driven. You have to really want to do it, or find your love for this, or find your passion. You'll be fine. It's almost like we try and teach these things rather than set up the environment like play, like all the things you've spoken for it to emerge on its own. We're just trying to say, oh, no, this is it. Now go and do it.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Joe. And you certainly you can't implant this.
You
know?
Yeah.
It really comes from your own experience and the way your brain codes your experience. I did this exercise years ago with the family educator, and we're working with all the parents in this big school in DC. And we made up these scenarios, like you got a third grade girl who coming home crying because she's the only kid in her friend group who didn't get invited to a party. Or you got a 10th grade son who gets cuts from the basketball team, or his girlfriend dumped him, and he's really distraught. That the question that we ask parents to ask themselves is, whose problem is it? Mm-hmm. We encourage, we try to inhibit that, because we're mammals, we're wired to soothe and protect our young. And so it's so easy for us to keep going, well, you can do, that's not so bad to soothe them, or you need to do this or that. And if we don't do that, and they have the experience of solving their own problem, it changes their brain in a way that has nothing to do with you need to be like this. It's just that's who they become. And so we want them to have those experiences in life that shape their development, shape their brain development in a way that they spontaneously feel a sense of control. It's not something that they feel, sense of autonomy. They feel that this is my life. They feel that I'm competent in doing this. They feel that I have agency, because that's what I've experienced.
No one's become resilient because they've been told they should be resilient.
it'd be great if it did work that way, like, but yeah.
Well, it's true, and I think that, you know, just, do you folks have the growth mindset in England?
Yeah.
For our second book, I like the idea in general. The second book, we interviewed this woman who's done several studies on attempts to train a growth mindset. The growth mindset meaning, I know that I can get better at things through my own efforts, as opposed to, well, I'm born with a certain amount of ability, not much I can do about it. And that growth mindset, that it turns out it's a good thing, but it also turns out it's a very hard thing to kind of train kids in if they don't spontaneously have it.
And that's one of the things that made it through into the schools here. Most schools will know about it and they'll try and teach it.
Yeah.
From a young age.
Yeah.
They say you should have a growth mindset, you know, try it out.
I think that there's ways of encouraging kids to think like that, but just trying to teach them that way. you need to have a growth mindset doesn't work so well. And but in your email to me, you mentioned that your work on housework, you know, your housework program is based in part on motivational theory. For Ned and myself, our North Star for thinking about motivation is self-determination theory. Mm-hmm. That holds for kids to be intrinsically or internally motivated, they have to have three basic needs met: for a sense of relatedness, connectedness, for a sense of competency, and for a sense of autonomy. And I think your focus on housework is really important. It's wonderful. And certainly kids growing up having a sense that I'm competent. And interestingly, there's a question on one of the American intelligence tests where you simply ask kids, why is it important for children to do chores?
Oh, wow.
And they all know, you know, even kids say it's not, you know, and they all say it builds a sense of responsibility. Or you learn how to do things for yourself, so when you'll know how to do them when you're an adult. They all know. They all know that the value, and even apart from contributing to your family, kids know. And I think that I think that one of the questions you posed to me was, you know, why do so few kids do housework now?
Only one in four now, compared to 86% of when we were children.
Yeah. But I think part of that may be because so many parents don't do housework now, you know, because they hire somebody to do it. Yeah. And I think also that because we become increasingly anxious and fearful, thinking that the world is more and more competitive, the world is more dangerous and competitive than it is, we can't have a kid spend time cleaning the bathroom when they could be building a resume for college.
Yeah,
exactly.
There's a lot of that stuff too.
Why it's going the same way as play, because of this education, it's all about college.
I gave a lecture in Texas about the self-driven child a few years ago. And I happened to mention probably the most elite school in Washington, D.C., where parents, where presidents' kids go. And I don't remember why I mentioned it, but after the lecture, this woman came up to me and said, I'm a psychotherapist at the Menninger Clinic here in Houston. And we know the school really well. because so many of the graduates get into the top universities, but as soon as they get a B, as soon as they realize that everybody here is smart as I am, or as soon as a girlfriend dumps them, they crumble and they have to take a medical leave of absence and they come here for therapy. And she says, to the one, they don't have enough experience running, making their own decisions, solving their own problems, running their own lives. The kids who do their own laundry, it's a pretty powerful prediction of who's going to make it in college. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, and my kids used to complain when they're in high school that they're the only ones in their friend group who had to do their own laundry. And I just say, you couldn't make me more proud.
I love it. I just love it so much. It's almost like we're preparing children for the life that they won't have. No one will have just the life of their nose in the book and competing with their peers all the time. Thankfully, no. Right. The actual life involves quite a lot of housework.
It's true. Yeah, it's true.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you.
This is our traditional last question. What do you do for play, Dr. Stixrud?
Well, I'm still a rock and roll guy. I play in a rock and roll band, and I play in the band I'm in now. I've been in a couple bands in the last 30 some years. I play guitar and keyboards and sing.
Favorite Beatles song? Favorite album?
That's tough. I would say that my favorite Beatles song is, I'm embarrassed to say this, I love She Loves You.
Yeah.
I go way, way back. I love it. I mean, I love Let It Be too. I mean, I'd say that's right up there.
Oh yeah, Let It Be really goes with the sound-driven child.
Yeah, just the non-anxious presence, you know, let it be. Accept, you know, we talk in both our books about the idea of radical acceptance, meaning that for all we know, whatever a kid's experiencing right now is what they're supposed to be experiencing. This is the right part of their path, because I've never seen a plan for your kids that somehow this is way off course, and making peace with where they are now. This must be where they're supposed to be, because this is where they are right now. Makes us more flexible to help, more able to help without panicking, and letting kids be, because I remember testing. I worked with this kid who years ago had polio as a child, and he had a brace on his leg, and it didn't seem to bother him very much until he got into eighth grade. He was interested in girls. He couldn't play sports anymore. And his dad said, first he said, this should be the happiest time in his life. And I said, obviously you skipped eighth grade, because most eighth grade, it's not the happiest time in most people's life. But then he said through tears, he said, I just want him to feel good about himself. And I said, I think we can much more convincingly help him feel good about himself if we aren't worried sick. And so this idea of, you know, let it be. We don't have to worry about it constantly. Let it be. This is part of the path now. And now, let's think, how can we support him? How can we help him? But let's not catastrophize. Let's not create an unnecessary anxiety. This is going to make it worse. This is going to make him even more afraid.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, yes, thank you.
I just loved every minute of it.
I really enjoy being with the two of you. I like what you're doing. And thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Make sure you give us a follow. Sign up on our website to find out about our next guests. We've got some great guests coming. And follow us on social media too, and stay tuned, because we've got more planned.